This is the second in a series of two podcasts talking about a broad overview for methodology research in HCI. And last time what we talked about was three things. Why do we do evaluation in human-computer interaction research? What methods exist to do research there, to do evaluation essentially? And why we should actually use different methods and perhaps multiple methods to conduct that research or evaluation. And today what we're going to talk about is how we can actually go about comparing these methods. And the way that we're going to do this is I'm going to be giving you a set of vocabulary that you can use to think about these different methods. And so depending on the needs that you have for your question, you can actually go ahead and be able to articulate kind of the needs, those needs within this vocabulary. And based on that articulation, you can actually go ahead and choose a method that makes some sense. So I'm not going to necessarily link this vocabulary with specific methods, because of course, at the end of the day, you can always modify a particular method depending on your specific needs. So just to start, so again, a way of thinking about this vocabulary is that you can use this to think about how these different methods actually differ. So just a couple of quick things, right? So naturalistic and repeatability. So with respect to naturalistic, what we're actually asking the question is the method being applied in an ecologically valid situation? So when we're talking about field studies or ethnography or contextual inquiry, what we're talking about is actually going ahead and studying people or studying a system kind of people and their use of that system in the context that we actually expect them to be using it, right? So these are real world settings, right? A real environment, real tasks, real people, real motivation, right? As soon as you interrupt that flow, as soon as you insert yourself, you're actually going to change that flow necessarily. This is actually what happens, right? So think about if you were to stick a camera down in the middle of a busy intersection, that actually changes people's behavior, right? If that camera is there for a long enough period of time, then you would expect people to sort of habituate to that camera, and then they just kind of go about their everyday activity. Of course, if that camera has a very big footprint, they're going to need to walk around the camera. So it will eventually, in some ways, it may still affect them. So when we use these naturalistic techniques, we want to try to avoid disrupting kind of what's going on. We often want to avoid disrupting what's going on while we kind of try to gather whatever piece of information we want to gather. Right? Although now that I said that, it kind of still depends, right? If you're perhaps introducing some intervention, perhaps you're actually trying to change the way that they actually do things. Right? But that intervention may be being applied in a naturalistic way, that is, you're putting it out there as a deployment. So it just depends. You would still call that naturalistic. But that goal of kind of not disrupting anything, obviously you're kind of compromising that one. Repeatability, right? So do you expect the same results to be achieved if you conduct that test again? Right? So with lab studies, you typically expect to have good repeatability. With interviews, you don't necessarily expect the same kind of thing. Right? It just depends. Depends on what your needs are. Some other vocabulary that's very useful includes validity. And in psychology, actually, we talk about validity a long time, right? A lot. But what it comes down to is two basic questions with respect to external validity and internal validity. External validity has to do with answering the question, can the results be generalized? Can they be applied to other situations? Do we expect these results to... do we expect the same result in other situations more broadly? Right? So if we conduct a small evaluation of a toothpaste and we have a small sample of 10 people, do we expect the results that happen in those 10 people to happen kind of with the population? Right? External validity. Internal validity has to do with having confidence in your explanation of what actually happened. Right? So there are, and the best way to think about this is that there are often threats to internal validity and we need to manage them as researchers. So as a quick example, let's pretend that we were doing an evaluation of toothpastes. And, you know, with our brand new toothpaste, what it comes with is a researcher that sits there and brushes your teeth for you. And if you're using the old toothpaste, you just got to do it yourself. Obviously, we're introducing a problem, right? And that problem is that we are, in the case with the new toothpaste, we're actually having somebody brush your teeth for you. And that actually introduces what we call a confound. But we'll get into that again later. But the point is, you want to be able to have confidence in your explanation of what happened, right? So you want to remove situations where you're introducing bias to bias the results one way or another. Another way to think about this, if you're applying HCI methods kind of in the real world where you are designing some kind of product, your basic question has to do with, does the test measure something relevant to the usability and the usefulness of real products in real use outside of the lab, right? And often we're conducting these pieces of research inside of a lab rather than kind of out in the real world, right? This is actually introducing reliability problems. You're not using like typical users, perhaps. You're kind of having them do tasks that are not really normal tasks. You're perhaps really focused on something that doesn't really matter, right? Trying to evaluate some certain usability problems rather than usefulness. In a lab, it's often quiet rather than noisy and having a lot of interruptions. And then obviously there are social influences, right? So if you're standing over and hovering over someone, again, this is not naturalistic, right? It's introducing certain bias into your evaluation. So a partial solution for addressing this is to actually go back and say, okay, well, we need real users, so bring in real people, right? We need real tasks rather than fake made-up tasks, right? You might construct an environment that is actually similar to the real situation. So I've certainly seen evaluations where we actually interrupt users, and that's part of the entire task, essentially. They're trying to complete some task, and a subtask is addressing interruptions as they happen. Right? So trying to construct a context that's similar to a real situation. Right? In a lab, the desk that they're sitting at looks nothing and feels nothing like the desk that they're sitting at work. Right? This desk that they're sitting at work might be, you know, very messy, and the desk that they're sitting at in your lab is very clean, there's nothing on the table, so on and so forth. Right? Other ways that we can compare method, how quick can it be done? Right? So if you are talking about interviews, these actually take a substantial amount of time to conduct and perhaps to analyze. If you contrast that against a survey takes a long time to put together, right? Because you want to debug that survey, make sure that you're not asking redundant questions, make sure that these survey questions are actually getting at what you want. But deploying it is super easy, right? You just send it out. And hopefully 100 or 200 people are going to answer for you, right? So certain methods are quicker to do than others. Some field work where you're actually doing an ethnography and you're going to try to become a part of that environment or a part of that culture, that's going to take some time, right? There, in the sociology and anthropology literature, there are ethnographies that are written by people who have immersed themselves in a culture for several years, right? So obviously that is not often a very quick method. It just depends. Is the cost for using this method reasonable for my question, right? So, and in fact, one way to think about cost is how many participants am I going to recruit? Right? Is the question that I'm asking useful or important enough to actually cost the company this amount of money? When I worked for Microsoft, it turned out that each participant that we recruited cost the company something in the order of, you know, $2,000. Yeah, and this is, and the way to think about that $2,000 is it's, you know, $20 of some free product that we give them, but it's also the amount of time that it takes to go through the potential participant list, to match the criteria that we're looking for, to give them a call, to have HR handle whatever they need to handle, to do whatever tax stuff they need to do, to actually bring them onto campus, to do the paperwork, to take care of their parking, to have one of the admins or the secretaries walk them up, right? All of these things add up to something like $2,000 a person. So for some questions, you might just be like, well, maybe I should do this on my own without costing the company anything, right? But there are other questions where it might be really, really important. The other part of this is to think about, it's not only your cost, but also the cost of perhaps the company that you're building something for. So in the case of the University of Calgary, if we were trying to replace PeopleSoft somehow, and you are the company that is actually building, you know, PeopleSoft 2, right? If you were doing this, you would want to bring in people that are going to be using the system. That is, potential users, right? From HR, potential students that actually make use of this thing, admins that make use of this thing. You're going to want to bring those people in. And depending on their job function, though, it's going to be expensive for the University of Calgary to give you all access to all of these people for as much time as you would like. Right? So cost is not only to you, but potentially your customer, too. Sometimes certain evaluations require special equipment or special resources, people that are trained to run that equipment. Particular examples of this might include things like eye trackers, right? An eye tracker actually is a piece of specialized equipment. Can you actually bring an eye tracker out into the field? Generally, no. Generally, you need to set it up in a very quiet environment, right? That is very calm, right? And as a consequence, that constrains what kind of method you can choose, right? You can't use that kind of technology if you're expecting to study, let's say, how people use mobile phones out in, you know, out while they're biking, let's say, right? You're going to have to choose a different method. Personnel training and expertise. What kind of people or expertise are required to run this method? Some other ways that we think about this stuff. Subject selection. How many do I need? Who are they? And how can I get them? In a lot of the studies that we do inside of this lab, we often just get students, right? But if you think about this, this biases our results in a very fundamental way. It means that all of our results are from basically students, so somewhat highly educated members of our society that are probably, you know, middle class, essentially middle class or higher, because they need to afford to be able to come to school. They're also of a particular age range, right? Probably between 18 and, you know, 25 or so. And again, often this is associated with socioeconomic status and a particular kind of background. So maybe this is okay, but it just depends, right? And then again, how many do you need to answer the question that you need? Right. So in a survey, you're potentially trying to get access to 50 to 100, maybe 1,000 people. In a lab study, you're probably trying to tackle somewhere in the order of, you know, 8 to 16 participants, right? It just depends. And of course, if you can get more answers from more people, it gives you a better sense of what's going on. If you're getting only, you know, 5 people's opinion or 2 people's opinion of something or an assessment of something, that gives you less of a rich picture. The scope of the subjects may differ too, right? So are you trying to analyze individuals as they make use of a system, or are you trying to analyze the performance or how an entire organization does something? So in the case of an ethnography, you're actually trying to understand an entire culture, right? A system of people and practices and artifacts. Whereas with a lab study, you're actually trying to study an individual. So this is one way in which kind of these different methods differ. The type of information that you're collecting, is it qualitative or is it quantitative information? Quantitative information means essentially that it's associated with numbers somehow, right? Quantities. So if we're evaluating the performance, people's performance with the system, often we're trying to evaluate how quickly they can complete some task, right? Time and errors. How many mistakes do they actually make? Whereas with qualitative analysis, what we're trying to do is we're trying to collect, you know, their verbal feedback about how something is working, right? Their opinions on things, right? Quantitative information is often more amenable to certain types of statistical tests than qualitative methods. Comparative, right? So are using the evaluation to compare things, right? So if you have things that you're actually trying to compare, or you're actually just trying to study one thing. So some methods actually just have you study one thing, right? And ethnography is not rarely a comparative thing necessarily, although it sort of implicitly is. Whereas in a lab study, you're often trying to compare something new to a baseline, where you're trying to say, this is faster than X, right? Right? Or X is faster than a keyboard, whatever it might be. Other words that are useful, control, right? Can you control for certain factors to see what effects they have? So, for example, if you are trying to study people's performance clicking into a menu, a factor that you can control is how many items appear in that menu. Is it 3 items? Is it 6 items? Is it 9 items? Is it 12? Right? How long does it take for people to select an item from a menu of 12 versus how long does it take for people to select a menu from a menu of an item from a menu of 3? Right? So you're controlling for that factor. Right. Other things that you might control are what is the ordering of the items in that menu. Right. Some studies you're actually trying to do as a longitudinal study. Right. So, for example, suppose you put together a learning system where the idea is that it teaches kids to do math. It's unlikely that you're going to have performance gains immediately, right? Within 15 minutes. Instead, what you'd likely do is you deploy that system with a classroom and you study how they use it over the course of a year. And over the long term, at the end of the year, you assess whether they've actually learned something. And you compare that, perhaps, with another class that didn't get your tutorial system. Right? You might even go back 5 years on and see whether those differences actually are retained. These kinds of longitudinal studies are obviously quite expensive and they're long term. So another way of doing this is sort of to cross-section your population and essentially study people at different age categories, right? Rather than study a system, perhaps you're just trying to assess what their cognitive abilities are or what they know at different parts of the education system, let's just say, for that example. The setting is something that we've talked about. Is it that they're going to do the study in a lab, or are they going to do it in the field where they're used to doing the things, right? And a lab is where they're unaccustomed to. What kind of support do you have for using the method or analyzing the data? So a simple example is on campus at the University of Calgary, we have a guy upstairs. His name is Tak Fung. He's our stats guy. So if you have a study where you need to get some statistical tests run, he's your guy. He can help you to figure out what tests need to be run and how they should be done. Some other resources that we have on the in the university, we have coding tools that you can use for quoting qualitative data. How can you? Some other things that you can do. Is there actually a standard method for studying this particular situation? Can we reuse an existing method rather than construct a brand new one? That is there a fairly standard way to apply this method to these situations? What kind of results does it produce? Does it produce a descriptive result? Does it produce an explanation? Does it produce a predictive theory? Right? Metrics. This is a piece of vocabulary. These are useful, observable phenomena that can be measured. So things that you can measure. So as an example, as I talked about before, how long does it take for somebody to complete some task? How many errors are they making? Right. So these are metrics. Some other things that you can talk about, measures. Can I see processes or how something is done or outcomes? Do I have a way of measuring those outcomes, right? Sometimes they're new things that I can measure in terms of a number. Sometimes they're things where I can say, oh, they're doing this, then they're doing this, right? A set of processes or a set of steps, right? There are some studies that you can that you can include within an organization as part of a software development process, right? So we've talked a little bit about iterative design. We've talked about user-centered design. Can we apply these methods? Right? It just depends on the situation. Finally, are there politics that you need to address in a particular situation? So if you're working for a company, and you know somebody has method. A preference for a particular method that may constrain your choice. Right. So what I've tried to do here is try to provide you with a vocabulary and a set of sort of parameters that you can use to think about different methods and how they differ. We talked a little bit about the learning goals for the entire course, and something that might be useful now is to take this set of vocabulary, go back to the methods that I introduced in the first lecture there and try to see which ones of these pieces of vocabulary apply to which method. So in total, what you know now are how we do, why we do evaluation in human-computer interaction, why we use different methods, how we can compare these methods, and what some of these methods are. Thanks.